1290 and 95.7 FM. News Talk Radio WHIO and Sim Trainer Indoor Range and Firearms Training Center present Shooting from the Hip. It's straight talk about firearms, ammunition, self-defense, when and where you can carry, legislation, and legal issues. All about safety, training, and so much more. Your hosts are Jeff Pedro and Mark Avery. Jeff is a 24-year veteran police officer, currently assigned City of Kettering Detective, and owner and lead instructor at Sim Trainer. Mark is a retired Air Force officer, senior staff instructor at Sim Trainer, and NRA-certified instructor in multiple disciplines. They're here to bring to the microphone the truth about guns. Join them by calling 457-1290. Now, Shooting from the Hip. On AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM. News Talk Radio, WHIO.
I want to welcome our listeners to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip, brought to you by Sim Trainer, the Dayton area's first indoor range and firearms training center. And as we promised you last week, we have an action-packed hour in store for you. We have Chief Richard Beal from the Dayton Police Department with us today, who's going to talk to us and help trying to sort through some of the information on violent crime in the Dayton area. I know it's a topic that has come up quite often, and we wanted to go right to the source, and he has some pretty reliable source data that his staff has gathered for presentation specifically for this particular broadcast. I want to start off the hour and just mention that it's been a good week. As we promised last week, 2010 is probably going to be a very instrumental year in the development of national politics, and Tuesday was a great day. And the thing I want to emphasize about that, Mark, and I'm sure you agree, the people have spoken, and your voices do matter, and you need to get out there and express your opinions on the related issues, because you can have a significant impact in the outcome of these sorts of issues.
And, of course, there's going to be a whole lot of stuff going on between now and November, and we'll be keeping on top of it as best we can here as well, especially as it relates to firearms and right to carry and that sort of thing.
That's awesome. Let's get right to it. I want to encourage our callers to call in with any questions you might have at 457-1290. And I'm going to start off. I would like you, Chief Beal, just to tell the audience a little bit about yourself and what you see your role here today as being.
Well, I guess I'll start saying I've been the police chief for the city of Dayton for the last 2 years. And so it's amazing how fast 2 years can go. Prior to coming to Dayton, I didn't come from very far. I actually came from Cincinnati, Ohio, where I was born and raised and spent the majority of my law enforcement career with the Cincinnati Police Department, which I began in 1980, and then I finished my last 6 years as assistant police chief and retired in July of 2004. Following that, I actually went to work with a nonprofit organization called the Community Police Partnering Center, whose sole mission was to work with citizens to work with Cincinnati Police to make for safer neighborhoods. In fact, one of the messages that I take to the community everywhere I go is that public safety has always been a civic responsibility.
How about that? How about that? Yeah, absolutely true. If the individual citizens don't recognize their role in that, there's nothing that the police can do. I mean, you can't, there's only going to be so many police. There's just no way that you can take care of all of that if the people aren't part of that process and helping you every chance they get.
And that's my message. And the other way I really kind of illustrate that is that I mentioned that, you know, a lot of folks, including my teenage son, our middle son, loves CSI. I said, so it's a great show, very interesting and entertaining, and he loves it. But I said, to this day, and I just taught a class at Wright State this week, and I mentioned this as an issue. To this day, despite increases in forensics, despite increases in technology, despite increases in improvements in investigative techniques, the single most important factor, whether police solve a crime or not, is whether citizens can tell them who did it. Mm-hmm. To this day. So policing is everything, every bit about partnership and having a working relationship with citizens. It won't work any other way, and that's why I always start with any comment saying that public safety is a civic responsibility. It goes already back to the principles of Sir Robert Peel, the father of modern policing, who basically said the public are the police and the police are the public.
That's awesome. And that holds true in quite a wide range of areas. When you talk about community policing initiative, I know that the city of Dayton has kind of been the leader in that in this region. Coming from Cincinnati, I'm not sure if you went from the pot into the fire or or vice versa. I know that both of them are pretty difficult cities to police, but you came up here to Dayton, and one thing that I would just like you to talk about a little bit here to our audience is you present some pretty interesting preliminary data. I mentioned last week that the FBI uniform crime reports for the year 2008, which were just published, indicated that there was a pretty substantial drop, about 10% drop in violent crime. And you have some data that kind of
mirrors that. Let me just say in FBI reporting that you typically talk about Part 1 crime. And Part 1 crime is basically considered serious crime, and it's made up of crimes against persons, so violent crime, murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. And then the property crimes are motor theft, larceny, arson, and burglary. So we track that data like all police departments do. They're always staying on top of what we call Part 1 crime or serious crime. And both the violent crime and the property crime of Part 1 crime is down 6% this past year in the city of Dayton. The news, if we will, on gun crime is even better. Aggravated assaults alone by firearm were down 25%.
Wow.
And in the last 5 months, violent crime by firearm with injury is down more than a third.
Awesome.
So even though the statistics for the year end in some cases aren't quite as dramatic, over the past 5 months they are, and we really expected that because we – and I say we because as a region, it was the Dayton Police Department, Trywood Police Department, Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, all came together a little more than a year ago and implemented the community initiative to reduce gun violence. And the way this occurs is there are individuals who are identified through street-level law enforcement intelligence who we have the best information that are caught up in this cycle of violence, illegal gun violence. And they are brought into a courtroom. Representatives of those groups are brought into the courtroom. They're given a very specific message that the shooting must stop. It must stop now, and we're not asking, and that if you don't put the guns down, consequences will be certain. They also hear from the community, which I think is the most powerful voice in that room, to express to these young men, and almost entirely young men, that the community can no longer stand by and accept the level of gun violence that's going on, that the community will step up, will support police and law enforcement, taking all and every legal means to end it because they wanted to stop too. And there's also individuals in the room. If somebody wants out of a lifestyle that's putting them at risk, there's help in that room through social services. So that's the intervention, and we knew it would take us to the second or third cycle of that before we would likely see significant decline with a third series of those call-ins. We're at the end of August, so looking at literally the day after those interventions in Montgomery County Common Police Court, today, actually till Thursday, the 21st, our violent crime firearm with an injury is down one-third compared to the previous year.
Well, what's really interesting, and I think at the same time somewhat frustrating, is the media really doesn't put that out there, and I just wish they'd do a little bit better job because they go with the contrary, and sometimes they cite source data that isn't nearly as reliable. And I'm going to just let you respond to this. I think your data is tremendously reliable because you're up on it day to day. You probably have staff members assigned to that task, and they're reporting to you, and you expect results, and then you would analyze that data, and you address the programming accordingly. Is that correct?
Not only is that correct, we've taken it a step even further. This has been totally automated. We have what we call real-time data. Every single day, all of our crime data is updated on something called our EIS, or Executive Information System. And so I can track these trends day by day by day.
Awesome.
So it is literally at our fingertips, at our desktop computers, and I go on every week and sometimes multiple times during the week just to check crime data in particular, but gun crime in particular.
Awesome.
We are about ready to take our first break, so I'd like to invite folks that are listening that have a question for Chief Beal to give us a call at 457-1290. Jimmy will take your call and get you up on the board. We'll take a short break now, and we'll be back in just a few minutes on WHIO.
Call in with your question or comment at 457-1290. This is the Ask the Expert Show, shooting from the hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM. News Talk Radio, WHIO.
The Second Amendment to the United States Constitution is part of the United States Bill of Rights that protects a right to keep and bear arms. The meaning and scope of this right has been described as among the most contested of the rights. A decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2008 determined that a ban on home possession of an operable firearm, such as a handgun, violates the Second Amendment. That ruling, however, only applies to federal laws and jurisdictions, leaving it unclear what kinds of firearms regulations the state governments can adopt without running afoul of the Constitution. Stephen T. Pearson, attorney at law, has been protecting your Second Amendment rights for 25 years. Stephen T. Pearson is a criminal defense attorney here in the greater Dayton area, specializing in conceal and carry law and anything involving the Second Amendment. You can contact Stephen T. Pearson at 299-2995, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Stephen T. Pearson, attorney at law, 299-2995.
Hi, I'm Mark Craighead, founder of Crossbreed Holsters. I designed our top-selling holster, the Super Tuck Deluxe, to solve the problems of being poked, pinched, and gouged while carrying concealed. The Super Tuck Deluxe is the most comfortable, most concealable holster on the market today. We offer a 2-week free trial and a lifetime warranty.
Visit us at crossbreedholsters.com. Don't forget, crossbreedholsters.com.
Hi, this is Cam Edwards from NRANews.com, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Okay, welcome our listeners back to this episode of Shooting from the Hip. As I mentioned earlier, our guest today is Chief Richard Beal with the Dayton Police Department. He's given us some interesting data. And right before the break, we talked about how the media sometimes doesn't accurately portray the data as they're presented. And one of the things I want to have you comment on, Chief, is they talk about the acquisition of firearms, where people are getting guns that they commit crimes with. What's some of the data that you've come across and some of the information that has been sent your way, reference to where they're getting the guns that they ultimately commit crimes with?
Yeah, I would say in terms of locally, I haven't looked specifically at the guns that we seize and you did a complete study or comprehensive study to say where they're coming from. Clearly, a number of them are stolen in burglaries. That certainly is a frequent source of illegal firearms. There is some cases individuals who are not legally allowed to have a firearm because they're considered to have have weapons under disability. They're precluded by state law.
Right. In some cases, federal law.
Yes, right. Based on convictions, based on a history of chemical dependence, alcohol dependence, other factors from having a firearm. Are able to acquire them. There are some issues related to gun shows. I mean, we do policing of the gun shows because we know there are individuals who are not entitled to have firearms that go there to try to acquire one. And there still is issues with straw purchases that occur. So there's a number of mechanisms by which individuals obtain illegal firearms. And really, there's a strategy needed for all of those mechanisms.
Exactly. Would you clarify for the audience what you refer to as straw purchases?
Well, that's where someone would who can acquire a legal firearm because there would be no prohibition against them possessing it by state or federal law, would go in and make a purchase and then basically hand that gun off to someone who is not legally able to possess that firearm.
Yeah, and there's a big program by the National Shooting Sports Foundation called Don't Lie for the Other Guy, and all the gun dealers in town are well aware of that and recognize the problem of a straw purchase and do everything they can to avoid it. But if somebody's going to lie to you, they're going to say, yeah, that's for me, and yeah, I'm buying it, I'm the real purchaser, first they've committed a felony if that's not true. But if they're going to do it, how's the gun dealer? There's a lot of things we can look out for and always do, but even so, that's the problem, that you've got somebody who's a criminal who's intent on doing something wrong, and they're gonna lie in order to get that done.
Yeah, matter of fact, the first question on the 4473 are you the person buying the gun for yourself? And obviously, if they're not, they're going to answer yes to that because they're not going to draw undue attention to themselves. And I will say that the local task force and local law enforcement agencies have been doing a tremendous job on the local level policing that, and we don't necessarily need outside agencies coming in to do that for us because we're doing a pretty good job doing that. Do you feel the same way, or do you work closely with
Well, we have certainly have a relationship with all federal law enforcement agencies. You know, probably our strongest relationship is with the FBI and Safe Streets Task Force.
Right.
Also, we have a relationship with DEA dealing with the issue of drugs. We do certainly cooperate with ATF. We have personnel that work with the FBI deal with the issues related to terrorism. So there's probably not a federal law enforcement task force right. in the region that we're not engaged in some right. way, and in fact work to cooperate fully with any agencies that ask for our assistance. I would say that our focus here in the city of Dayton is significantly on policing gun offenders. And I would say that what was really helpful for us is that when we came together, we not just the city of Dayton, really we as a region, the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, Tropwood Police Department, the Dayton Police Department, we had officers from all our jurisdictions come together and literally name the names. It is phenomenal the amount of intelligence that exists with police officers out on the street who really do have a very good idea of who's involved in illegal gun crime and, in fact, who's driving gun violence. What the challenge was to get that information and pull it all together. And that's what has been done through the cooperation of these three agencies, along with support from FBI Safe Street Task Force, the adult parole, common pleas probation. So all of these entities working together literally to name the names. And so we have a very, I think, pretty comprehensive list of who is driving the gun violence in the region. And so the focus of law enforcement efforts have been on those individuals. And they're the ones who are brought to this courtroom because they're on probation or parole. They're required to be
right.
there and given this very no-nonsense message about what will happen if the guns aren't put down.
Would you say it's safe to say that there's a significant amount of the gun crime is done by drug-related offenders and gang-affiliated offenders when you look at the total volume versus just the typical Joe off the street that comes across, you know, the criminal justice system?
Yeah, interestingly enough, though, it's a lot of times there's this belief that it's gun violence related to the drug trade. And at least what David Kennedy, who is one of the Harvard researchers who helped develop this strategy in Boston more than a decade ago, and it was so successful it became known as the Boston Miracle, literally reducing homicides by two-thirds within a couple of years. Remarkable success. What he found is a lot of this gun violence, although certainly a lot of these individuals are caught up in the drug lifestyle, mm-hmm. it isn't necessarily related to business. It's really more personal beefs. Some of it clearly is gang related. Some of it, though, is just families that have violent history. So we use the term group member involved because it isn't always gang related. It may be drug gang, if you will. It could be street gang or street gang, and it can be families that have a very strong history of violence, so it kind of goes across the spectrum. But more often than not, the kind of senseless, crazy, and really distressful shootings that occur in broad daylight and, you know, and sometimes in residential areas, it's really these personal beefs. Mm-hmm. It isn't like people are, you know, competing over turf for a drug market.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go out to the phones. We've got a few folks calling that if you'd like to get on the phone and ask a question of Chief Beal, you can call us at 457-1290. Let's go talk to Tommy out in Centerville. Tommy, you have a question for us.
Yes. I have a question about concealed carry in an automobile.
Okay.
Can you wear concealed carry while driving, or does the weapon have to be locked?
No. If you have a license to carry concealed handgun in Ohio, you can have that gun on your person, and it does not have to be visible. When the law was first passed, the Ohio law required that the gun be visible, it be in plain sight. And that provision was changed with the first major change to the law. So, no, you don't have to have it locked. That is another way that you can carry with a loaded gun in your car. But the only way you can have a loaded gun in your car is if you have a license to carry concealed handgun, and it can only be a handgun. And for other folks, the other definition of loaded gun was changed in September of 2008, and that definition is that not only is the gun unloaded, but you must not have any loaded magazines or speed loaders.
Question for Chief Hill. Now this is officers. Nobody would like the people that they stop to react, assuming they have a concealed carry on them.
Okay, so if somebody has a license to carry a concealed handgun and they're armed, how's the best way for them to deal with your officers if they're stopped?
Well, they certainly need to alert the officer that in fact they're carrying a weapon and that Absolutely. They have a license to do that. I mean, that has to be
the first words out of the mouth,
right?
Is what we recommend.
That shouldn't be late in the conversation. Yeah. That should be immediately stated. In fact, I mean, even before this law passed allowing this, I mean, if I was stopped as a police officer and having a weapon on me, the first words out of my mouth were going to be, I'm a police officer and I'm armed.
Mm-hmm.
That police officer has got to know that information from the very moment of that interaction.
Now, as a police officer, do the bad guys tell you when they're armed? Not so
the
much.
Ones who are carrying illegally? No.
Yeah, no. See, that's the thing. So when a law-abiding citizen who has a license to carry a concealed handgun has their hands in plain sight and they say, officer, I have a license to carry a concealed handgun, does that raise the stress level or reduce it maybe a little?
Well, I'm going to say officers will always be following universal precautions, but it certainly is a little bit reassuring that you have that information right away. So you have an idea what you're dealing with. And what really is concerning for police officers is the uncertainty of the nature of that contact and the intent of that citizen. If that can be resolved at the very beginning of that interaction, that takes a bit of the stress off, but officers should still maintain universal precautions.
Oh, absolutely. Tommy, thanks for giving us a call. We've got several other folks on the line. We'll get to them right after the news break, and we'll be out of here back in just a few minutes on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Relax and enjoy life. It's an Ask the Expert weekend on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Sim Trainer is the Dayton area's premier indoor shooting range and firearms training facility. Sim Trainer is a members-only facility featuring 10 individual shooting stalls and a mechanical target retrieval system. Their range is also climate controlled for your year-round comfort. Sim Trainer offers both pay-as-you-go and year-long individual and family memberships. They're also proud to offer reduced-rate memberships for law enforcement and military. Need training? Sim Trainer holds unique and innovative firearms training courses, including the award-winning First Shots program, a concealed carry course, and an advanced 5-course handgun series. Sim Trainer is open Monday through Sunday. Check the website, sim-trainer.com, to find out more or call 293-3914. Sim Trainer, the Dayton area's premier indoor shooting range and firearms training facility, 2031 Dryden Road in Moraine, just across from DPNL. Online at sim-trainer.com.
God bless America. This is your blood brother, Ted Nugent, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Learn more from the WHIO Ask the Expert weekends, help tips, automobile repair, home improvements, and more. AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. You're on with Shooting from the Hip. We're having a great time today talking with Chief Beal from the Dayton Police Department. But before we get back to Chief Beal, let's take a few phone calls. We've got Larry in Wapakoneta has a call for us. Question, Larry, what's your question?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I hear a lot about the concealed carry, but I own a woods, and we allow people to hunt in it. What I've noticed is several of the hunters, they're carrying long guns, but they're also carrying pistols in holsters on their hips. Are you allowed to carry openly in a holster? I mean, do you have to get a permit for that? Or?
You don't need a license or permit to do that. You do have to have a license to carry a concealed handgun to carry a handgun for personal protection in addition to your hunting weapon. So they probably do have licenses, but there's no requirement that they have a license to carry openly.
Okay, so in other words, what I'm asking is, can a general person just walk down the street and have a pistol in a holster openly? Is that legal to do that?
Yes, it is legal, but there are a lot of issues about doing that. Jeff, why don't you take that?
Yeah, as I've mentioned several times, the tactical advantage of doing something like that is far outweighed by the inconveniences that are going to be encountered, because you're going to raise inconvenience, annoyance, and alarm. Somebody's going to call the police. The police are going to respond to a call of a report of a man with a gun. They're going to put you down on the ground. They're going to handcuff you. They're going to take your gun from you. And even if you're legal, you're going to be subject to those inconveniences. So even though it's not addressed statutorily, there's no specific statutorial prohibition against it, it's just something that's not very well advised.
Okay.
Now, if you're out in a rural area, especially in some of the rural parts of Ohio where you have small towns and everybody knows everybody, yeah, that might be a little different. If you come into the larger metropolitan areas, it's probably going to you'll probably get a call. Somebody you'll probably get to talk to because it's just that much less usual.
And then one other thing I want to encourage you to do is check the Ohio Department of Natural Resources hunting rate rules and regulations, because during certain seasons or in certain circumstances, there may be some issues that are raised, but at least make sure you cover yourself along those grounds.
And that was a couple of years ago. They changed the regulations to allow those who have a license to carry a concealed handgun to have their personal protection. And that was a big deal. That was the first time that's happened. And when that was up for discussion, there was a huge number of comments, more comments than the DNR has had on any single subject before that. So does that kind of answer your question, Larry?
Yes, it does. The thing that I notice is when a couple of the gentlemen, when they get out of their pickup trucks, they'll have, like, the shotgun or whatever at the back window on a rack. But when they actually get out of the truck, they've already got the holster and the gun in. They're just getting out of the truck, and they're already carrying it.
Right, and that is perfectly legitimate way for someone to carry if they have a license to carry a concealed handgun.
Well, because I asked the one gentleman, I said, are you allowed to do that? He says, well, you're allowed to carry it openly. He says, I don't have a concealed. He says, it's open. He says, I'm not concealing it.
That's true, but he can't have it in the vehicle that way while operating the vehicle. So if you don't have a license to carry a concealed handgun, you cannot have a loaded handgun in your car. And as we mentioned just before, the definition of loaded includes having a loaded magazine or a loaded speed loader. So he's perfectly legitimate in having an open carry outside the vehicle, but not while you're driving and not when you're operating the vehicle.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your call.
That's a great call, Larry. Thanks for giving us a call here at 457-1290. Let's go talk to Rick in New Carlisle. Rick, you have a question about renewing a concealed carry license.
Yes, sir, I do, and thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
When I took my class, my license runs out July of this year, and they said at that time all you have to do is just go pay and they'll renew it. Said however, after the second 4 years, they wasn't sure. Said you may have to go take another test and get a refresher course.
That's correct.
Okay.
Your first license was 4 years. From now on, it'll be 5 years.
Okay.
And then after you've had it, your certificate that you got when you took the first class was good for 6 years. So at that point, when you're now 9 years into the process, you'll need to have a refresher class. Basically, what it's called is a range recertification. The specific details on what that requires hasn't been defined yet, and it's going to be 2013 before it's affecting anybody anyhow. So that's why I think there hasn't been any big sense of urgency in letting folks know what the requirement is for that. But, yes, there will need to be some sort of a recertification. It will not be the full class that you had to take to get the license.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate you answering that. And you fellows, keep up the good work. Appreciate listening to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We lost a call for you, Chief, but we've got another question that somebody has. On illegal immigration, is calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks.
Hello,
Jay. Thanks for giving us a call. I take it you're listening online.
Yeah, I am. I'm a native Daytonian. Been out here in Portland for about 16 or 17 years, and I ran across an article last week in the Dayton Daily News about no longer questioning immigration status for people that either reported crimes or been involved in minor crimes. I wanted to get first, give my input on that and then get some feedback as well. Out here in Portland, we've had that system for several years, and we are absolutely swamped right now with the illegal alien gangs, murders, and crime that goes with that. Because that standard has been set that we don't ask those questions, I wanted to understand what the justification is for that and if Daytonians understand what peril they're in now.
Well, thanks for asking, the rationale behind that is that if individuals are fearful of coming forward.
Yeah, but what if they've broken the law? I mean, illegal immigration is illegal.
Well, let me answer. You want to answer? Let me go to that part.
Sure.
The mere fact of being in the country undocumented is a civil violation. Local law enforcement is not a criminal. The police do not have the authority to take action on those kind of civil violations. So the first question is one of authority, but I really want to kind of go back because this was specifically related to victims and witnesses of crime. And the simple rationale behind that is if individuals are afraid to come forward and provide information to the police, that is when crime is going to continue to grow. And we really have ample evidence here locally as it relates to gun crimes where we know we could solve homicides, but citizens won't come forward. So if we take action that discourages citizens from coming forward, that's when crime's going to grow. This very specifically relates to victims and witnesses. And I also will mention that under federal immigration law, there is protection afforded under either T visa or U visa for victims of crime. So even federal immigration law allows for protection of victims of crime in certain circumstances. So I think we may have to make a distinction between those who are either witness or are victim of crime versus those who commit crimes.
So if somebody does commit a crime, will you ask for immigration status?
Well, actually, that will be checked when they go to jail. They actually, when they enter into the Montgomery County Jail, questions are asked the very early part of that interview. And if, based on the answer to those questions, there is an indication the person may not have legal status, then the Sheriff's Department notifies immigration. And before that person is able to be processed through the arrest process, they usually have an immediate response or a timely response from immigration, whether that person should be detained or not. And that is a process that is in place through the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office.
Well, I appreciate the feedback. I just wanted to let the folks there in Dayton know that when too much leniency is given to the folks that are here illegally, there's too much kowtowing to special interest groups that support them, the crime will go up. And I know you're trying to balance that against people reporting crimes, but I can tell you firsthand, I've watched Portland go from a very safe place to a very dangerous place, and it's all been surrounded around illegal immigration.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your call.
Let me just comment on that. I was a personal victim of a hit-and-run accident by a DUI driver who was an illegal. This happened in Kentucky. It wasn't in the Dayton area, and I will tell you that the local authorities were swift in apprehending that individual, swift in bringing him to justice. As a matter of fact, they sent me a letter a week out, and they asked if I minded if they immediately deported him back to where he came from in lieu of expenditure of all the funds to prosecute him, and obviously I had no objection. I thought that was an outcome. They assured me that a follow-up letter would come within a week, and they showed me not only a follow-up letter, but they actually gave me a copy of the paperwork where he was deported back to Mexico, all within about a three-week period of time. So I know that other authorities have addressed that issue. It is an ongoing problem, and they are addressing it in a very direct way.
How much problem do you have here in the Dayton area, Chief, with illegal immigration or people that are here illegally?
Well, I mean, again, I'll go back to terms of immigration itself. That is not a responsibility of local law enforcement, so that is an area that we don't take action to enforce if that's the only issue at hand. Now,
But when you're picking folks up that have committed crimes for other things, how many of those do you find that are illegal aliens?
Oh, well, very few of the people arrested. I mean, okay. I looked at this data very early on, and the first look at it was looking at individuals who were arrested for traffic offenses, and very, very, very few individuals from the Hispanic community were arrested. And actually, the early data looked at, in every single case when they were, it was only a traffic offense. There were no other, you know, it wasn't a crime, a reported crime. It was a traffic offense. And at least under the practices at the time with the Sheriff's Department, those individuals they found not to have legal status, they in fact were deported. Now, that was a concern for the Hispanic community who
sure.
clearly felt that deporting individuals for a traffic offense, you know, that should not be a priority for immigration enforcement. And although apparently the current policy, at least expressed, I think, through a recent study I read about immigration's policy publicly, is that they apparently do rank traffic offenses on a higher level priority than one would think it would deserve. So I know that's an issue of debate.
Okay. All right, we're going to take our last break for the hour. When we come back, we'll talk to Adam in Vandalia, and we'll talk to you. Give us a call at 457-1290. We'll be back in just a few minutes on WHIO.
You never know what you'll hear on the WHIO Ask the Expert weekend shows. Firearms, medical, inspirational, and more. AM 1290 and 95.7 FM. News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery with Jeff Pedro and Chief Richard Beal from the Dayton Police Department, and this is Shooting from the Hip. We're glad to have you with us. Give us a call at 457-1290 if you'd like to be on the show.
Chief, would you, earlier we were talking on the break about the murder rate in Dayton, and you mentioned that the numbers are consistent with what they were the year before.
They're going to be, I mean, we have a number of homicides that may, and I use the word may, be ruled justifiable. So there's, until those investigations are completed, we won't know what the final number. It will exceed what we had last year, at least by a couple of homicides. That is roughly, Dayton has run pretty much between 30 to 40 homicides throughout this decade. So it's getting close to 40 this year. Actually, it's 42 now, but if some of those are ruled justifiable, they'll be removed from the homicide data because they will not be crimes in that case.
That's for 2009?
For 2009. But so the point I really want to make is that we're having less people injured by gun violence, but more people dying. That can be driven by a whole host of factors. I mean, clearly, the number of times that a person is shot, where they are struck in the body.
Right.
If they seek medical aid immediately, that is a problem sometimes.
Right. Because of the circumstances.
Because of the circumstances, and that can literally be a fatal decision. I know one case where one of the homicides, clearly the person did not go immediately to hospital, they wound up dying. So there's a number of factors that determine whether or not that person dies or not. But if gun crime with injury was up and homicides are up, that would really be troublesome for our city. But the fact is we have a lot less people being injured through firearm violence. However, unfortunately and tragically, a few more have died as a result.
One question I'd just like you to answer very directly. Are you aware of any problems or any particular trends where law-abiding citizens who have concealed carry permits are committing illegal acts? I know a lot of our listeners are asking those types of questions, how they're going to be dealt with, but I'm talking law-abiding citizens who had concealed carry permits that got involved in something. Is that a problem in the city of Dayton?
Yeah, I guess do those things happen? I mean, here or even, you know, across the country, surely they do. The question is one of magnitude, and, you know, I'm not aware of anything locally that suggests that those who have concealed carry permits, in fact, are any significant problem. It's obviously something we need to monitor over time, like anything else, any other trend. If we would see an uptick in that, well, then we'd want to be taking a closer look. But at this point in time, certainly nothing's been brought to my attention, but there are certainly are cases where people across the country have, you know, the ability to carry a concealed weapon, in fact, do commit a crime. So it's not a, you know, it's not a pure world, if you would.
Right.
Nothing's quite that easy.
No, it's not that simple.
We have several folks on the line. Let's talk to Adam in Vandalia has a question. Adam, you're on Shooting from the Hip.
Yeah, hi. I have kind of a stupid question, but I recently just purchased my first new firearm, and I was just curious if that's already registered to me or do I need to have that done?
Well, first of all, there's no requirement that a gun be registered to you. The question I would ask you is, did you purchase that from a federal firearms licensed dealer?
Yes, I did.
Okay, you filled out the paperwork, and that gun, the only thing that did is authorize the dealer to transfer that gun to you. There's no, quote, registration, unquote, involved in that process. Now, there is a way, if that gun would somehow down the road be involved in the commission of crime, at least if it was right when it was taken maybe from your possession, stolen in a burglary or stolen out of your car, and if it was used in a crime, we could see that it was sold to you at a certain time, but that would not be any negative indication toward you or the gun itself. Now, if you were to sell it to another private individual where you wouldn't be required to fill out that paperwork and they in turn had the gun stolen or they committed a crime, again, it would come back to you and you would just say, I sold that gun to Joe Smith down the road 5 years ago, and what he did with it, that's basically his thing to deal with.
In short, there is no registration for firearms in Ohio. There's no federal registration for firearms except for automatic firearms, what are called NFA or Class 3 weapons. And There are some states that have their own registration schemes, but we're not one of them, and so this is part of the free United States.
Well, interestingly enough, the city of Dayton, up until recent years, had a firearms registration law or policy. Is that correct, Chief? And then the passage of the law in
I think that probably predated Chief
Beals
here in Dayton. Yeah. But that was preempted in 2007.
Absolutely.
And so those are not
right.
Those are not something that you have to worry about anymore. Adam, thanks for giving us a call here at Shooting from the Hip. Let's talk to Randy out in Tip City.
Hello.
Oh, yeah, Randy, you're on the air with Shooting from the Hip.
Okay. Hey, I want to say I'm sorry if you've already answered this question. But
that's all right.
When you guys were talking a little while ago about carrying concealed in a car.
Right.
Now, if I have my concealed weapons license, does it have to be concealed?
No, it doesn't have to be, but it can be. The point is that you can't have a loaded firearm in your vehicle unless you have a license to carry a concealed handgun.
Okay. I've got certain problems that cause me a little bit of discomfort when I get in the car and sit down. So if I take that off, and what would be the best way to carry it in that sense?
Well, if you're taking it out of your holster?
No, just taking it off my belt.
Okay.
While I drive.
It needs to be, one of the ways you can carry is in a holster on your person, but in a holster sitting on the seat wouldn't work. You can have it, you can carry in a console, secure it in a console or in a glove box. You can carry it in a case that closes, that has some sort of a latch. That was particularly added for women to carry in a purse. So something like that. It can be visible, but it needs to be secured in some way.
Okay. And one last quick thing.
Sure.
If I'm on my own property, does it still have to be concealed?
No. No, if you're on your own property, I mean, if you're living in close proximity to neighbors, that's a little different. Might want to, just for politeness, not want to be carrying an open handgun if that makes them nervous. But if you live in a place where, you're out in Tip City, so there is a little bit more space in some of those areas, and if you wanted to carry openly on your own property, there's nothing against that.
I'll just clarify that by saying when you're indoors, no issue, but when you're out cutting the grass, probably a good idea to keep it covered up, because again, some motorist driving by sees you cutting the grass with a gun on your hip, they're going to call the police. The police are going to come out there, and until they find out that you are a legitimate law-abiding citizen with the permit, your life's going to be interrupted for a short period of time.
Okay, but it's not illegal, though, right?
Not illegal, but again, I don't want to get you hung up on illegality versus practicality.
Yeah.
Right, I understand.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Randy,
thank you
great. Thanks for giving us a call. Let's go talk to Doug in Centerville. You have a question about ammunition? Doug, yeah. Are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. What's your question?
Okay. My question is when you go to the steakhouse and my wife decides to go eat out, I take off my gun, but do I have to take off all my spare ammo?
No.
Okay, so you're talking about like going into some place that serves alcohol.
Right.
Yeah. The law requires that you secure your firearm before you enter a Class D liquor permit premises. It doesn't specifically address the ammunition issue. As a matter of practicality, again, I'm going to recommend that you do that, although the law would not require that you do that.
Okay. That'll work.
Okay. Thank you for your question.
Great. Thanks for giving us a call. Let's take one more call. We'll talk to Bill, who's on a cell phone. And, Bill, you're on the air with Shooting from the Hip. What is your question?
Well, I would like to go back to that thing about the city of Dayton and registration of handguns. I used to be a resident of the city. I don't think you had to register your gun. I think you only had to register yourself as a handgun owner. There was no mention of what you had, how many you had, or anything like that, and I believe it was just a tool for law enforcement if they came upon the scene of a gun crime to say, show me your permit. I don't know if that's completely correct or not, but I'd like to be educated.
Your rationale is exactly correct. You were not required to register the gun. You were just required to register yourself as a gun owner. And basically, your analysis of what that purpose was is accurate for law enforcement, system investigations of criminal activity.
A bad law, as I remember. In fact, I had the card as a resident of the city.
Yeah, the law no longer applies, though, as a result of the passage of the amendment to the concealed carry law in 2007.
Bill, thanks for giving us a call and shooting from the hip. We're just down into the last minute, so we'd like to thank Chief Beal for coming and joining us.
You're welcome.
We'd love to have you come back sometime.
More than happy to.
Especially if there's something that comes up that you'd like to talk to the folks in Dayton about, we'd love to have you come back and talk to us.
Will do.
We really want to appreciate everybody who'd called in and those who've been listening to the show today. If you'd like to call us at the range, you can call us at 293-3914. Be back here next week at 2 o'clock when we'll be back with Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.